Before I bring the message of the hour, I should like to say a word about Golden Gate, since we're in our 25th anniversary year as we begin our work this fall, since we've just graduated a class that put us well beyond the 1,000 mark in those who have been a part and received acknowledgement and awards for their work in Golden Gate. And then especially to remind you again of a new story that you may have read earlier in the year, that the entire indebtedness for the construction of this campus, representing an expenditure of more than $6 million, has been paid. And that the cooperative program of Southern Baptists made this institution possible far out of the mainstream of the body of Southern Baptist life in terms of geography, and yet a spearhead not only in terms of the mission thrust to the West, but also in the midst of this great secular and intellectual climate, to be, as it were, a beachhead for Southern Baptists. And as I've looked across these 16 years I've been the president there, I have found a thrilling response in my own heart again and again as I see these young men and women now growing older who serve there in the West, and 2/3 of all of those who have ever attended Golden Gate have remained to serve in this vast area. Our first of the institutes for the urban church will be conducted at the latter part of this month. We are delighted with this emphasis in missions and evangelism and the effort of our trustees and administration to endow this chair, and with the coming, now nearly 2 years ago, of Dr. Francis DuBose to occupy that chair. There is one other, or two things that I'd like to do, and that is, first of all, to recognize one who has served with the seminary presidents and members of our faculty through the extension department that you have come to know so much about and so many of you have shared in one way and another. Because at the end of this calendar year, Dr. Ralph Herring will be retiring from this place of service that he has filled for these 7 years. I should like for Dr. Herring and those 4 men associated with him as associate directors, they're here on the platform, if they will, to stand. And there are 2 other groups here I'd like for you to see. All the members of the faculties and the administration of these 6 seminaries, wherever you may be sitting, seated here this morning, would you stand so that all may see you? They're scattered about all over, the great many of them here. And then another group, and a particular one that I expect to meet with this afternoon at 4 o'clock, I hope is here, the members of the Board of Trustees, not only of Golden Gate that I expect to see this afternoon, but of each of the 6 seminaries. Would these trustees stand wherever they are in the audience? Thank you so very much. A recent article in a theological quarterly began with these significant words, and I read, "We all worry about theological education. It is a fashionable, contemporary preoccupation. Actually, it is a very ancient concern. As soon as the church emerged, men began to think about the proper way of equipping those who hold forth the gospel. From the first, of course, it was apparent that character as well as knowledge was involved. The two are not exclusive alternatives, but mental equipment is always easier to assess than spiritual quality. We also assume it is easier to impart." Thus begins an article by Gerald Craig in Training for the Ministry. The title, I hope you recognize as being facetious and yet, in a sense, carrying with it the point I wish to make, Trouble in the Seminaries, was taken from an article written by President Roy Pearson of Andover Newton Seminary in a recent issue of the Christian Century, in which he stated so very well the case for the independent theological institution which emphasis has just been brought to your attention so well by President Naylor. Interest in theological education is indeed widespread, yes, among Southern Baptists as well, but too often under what might well be headed, there's trouble in the seminaries. Just offhand, any one of you would probably say that you know what theological education is and how it should be conducted. For any of you who think seriously about the subject, however, there soon appear questions that are troublesome and difficult. Just what is theological education? What are its purposes? What curriculum is necessary? In what setting should it be carried on? The questions are further complicated by our confused age. The preface of the case study for the Graduate Theological Union, one of these cluster affairs which Dr. Naylor mentioned over in Berkeley, California, put it this way, and I quote from their case study. As they described our day, they said, in both private and public realms, members of the church are uneasy, perplexed, often uninformed. In the private area of life lie fundamental questions of man's existence. What is the meaning of my life? How would I lead it personally? To what purpose should I dedicate my work? What is my ultimate destiny? In the public area, we find frightening wars, racial animosities, and increasing gaps between poverty and plenty, and of course, always the possibility and actual occurrence of devastating revolutions. None of us can continue along our old paths, they go on to say, as if there had been no Hiroshima or an Auschwitz prison, as if technology and science had not radically altered men's thinking and his actions, as if restless and ruthless populations were not exploding into vast metropolitan concentrations, as if man's dignity as a person and his life and supporting family or friendly community were not constantly threatened. The end of the quotation. Then they go on in their description of another challenge of the day to recall many of the dimensions, new dimensions of life now being opened to us, citing as but one example, the progress in medicine. But they go on to say that the conquest of disease after disease and the new possibilities ahead in the transplanting of organs are but part of a wider knowledge of the human organism and its possibility. And of course, we could add to this space travel, new developments in electronics, and the discoveries related to new sources of energy. So much for this world. How do we live in such a world? But more pointed to our subject, how do we prepare ministers to serve in it? One answer says, and I quote, with unmistakable urgency, theological education realizes it must come to the cultural, intellectual, and metropolitan centers where world issues and personal needs can be realistically understood. Institutions, curriculum programs, ways of teaching, habits of mind that were adequate for former times now demand new forms. The world has changed. Theology must take on new dimensions. And then this group, making this claim and uttering these statements, go on to say that it is now clear that theological education to meet the needs of the contemporary world is insufficient unless it is located near and involved with a world-renowned university. They add further that no respectable school can remain in isolation from the broad ecumenical thrust of this time. They would require common classes, faculty, and community life for all theological students. These two themes, relation to a secular university and the ecumenical emphasis, permeate theological education in many areas today. This is on the one hand. At the other extreme is the Bible Institute, or the possible trade school concept, some believing that knowledge of the Bible is all that is required, others feeling that methods, procedures, and programs will answer all our problems, that a seminary is primarily concerned with how to do it techniques. In such a world, and amidst these and other alternatives, Southern Baptists are busy at the task of theological education. We are seeking, as the convention's adopted program statement set forth, and I quote, to provide theological education with the Bible as the center of the curriculum, for God called men and women to meet the need for a trained leadership in the work of the churches, end the quotation. It needs to be added that the convention has also indicated implicitly that its objective to provide theological education without tuition charge is to be provided indeed to all God-called qualified persons who present themselves. Don't be misled by the simplicity of these statements. Some make the error of seeing only that we are to produce workers for the churches who can perform their tasks well. Indeed, it is our desire that they may perform well, but not just in a mechanical way. There must be a depth of understanding and an appreciation of the elements that make up our society if what is performed by church staff members has any effective and lasting meaning. A few well-written study course books could provide some practical know-how for a church worker, but effective leadership for making Christ's power known and accepted to change men's lives and their world comes only from the arduous discipline of mind, body, and spirit. The seminaries have the task not only of providing high-quality, educationally sound instruction, but of motivating the students who make full use to make full use of what is provided them. Theological education is more than the passing of courses, the accumulation of hours, and the earning of a degree, be it BD, Master of Divinity, or what have you. Several factors are making this task extremely difficult, however, in our day. Not the least of these is that of making a living for a family while one studies in the seminary. With 75 to 85% of the students married, this becomes a major concern. Higher standards of living plus high cost of living call for effort, which drains the and mentally and spiritually for their tasks. The strictly content courses have been accompanied by the so-called practical disciplines. The curriculum has been under constant scrutiny through many changes, even if often delayed. Continuing with the Bible at the center and the study of the original language as an important tool in its understanding, we no longer seek to make language specialists out of all our students. In my generation, strong emphases in psychology, Christian ethics, and comparative religion were added. Now, urban sociology and anthropology press for a place in the basic curriculum. There are those who would have these and other humanistic disciplines lessen our concern for study in depth of theology, Christian history, evangelism, and church administration. This pressure would de-emphasize, I am afraid, the local church fellowship. It seems to some of us that it makes of the minister more of a practitioner, like a doctor or a lawyer or a manipulator of social forces in the community. All of these considerations bring us back then to the question of purpose in theological education. Here you and others like you must give serious thought and expression in this day. Here, not all theological institutions you must recognize aim at the local church fellowship in the training of the largest portion of their students. For example, only 41% of the 1968 graduating class from Union Seminary in New York this year will seek ordination and enter the pastorate. In Yale Divinity School this year, only 17.6% of its entering students plan to become ministers in local churches. Reports from Baptist seminaries do not approach this level of non-pastorate ministry, but it is alarming nonetheless and needs your attention. Many factors affect this circumstance, some negative and others positive. On the positive side, many new and exciting avenues of service to humanity have opened up. Some of these call for ordination, and many do not. This is not bad. Humanity has needs which must be met, and some needs can be met by dedicated teachers, social workers, medical technicians, and other related professions. Some men and women with these concerns have previously thought that only through a church ministry could they serve. Now the government, various schools, and a multitude of social agencies offer channels for this service. But God calls some to preach, to be pastors, to serve in other church staff positions. These have a different motivation, I am convinced. Their aptitude, skills, and technical training may not separate them from others, but God's call and their commitment does. This the secular university can prepare for, but those who serve in the churches and their institutions must have their training in a different surrounding, or at least with a different spiritual dimension. Leaving out the spiritual dimension and the local church context, indeed the university is a proper place for preparation of social workers. But for those whose call relates them to the ministry through the churches, the contribution of the university is foundational but cannot take the place of the seminary. The study of religion on a university campus will be far more concerned with laymen than with those whose professional lives will be associated with church-related vocations. Now, this does not call for theological education in isolation. We are not proclaiming the gospel in a vacuum, nor are our claims for the gospel to be addressed primarily to the already convinced. To use an overworked word, what we have to say to this world must be relevant. This calls for an understanding of and an ability to communicate with the modern man. Further, we must seek to understand the community forces at work in the great urban centers of the world. This demands a knowledge of anthropology, of history, philosophy, sociology, as well as some understanding of comparative religions. Such knowledge and experience is necessary if we are to avoid uttering unintelligible sounds, using misunderstood phrases, and answering unasked questions. Men will not automatically understand us simply because we're sincere, dedicated, and speak with fervor. Nor can we expect to claim spiritual results if we speak only in the strength of our own individual knowledge and skills. Apart from the Spirit of God, we are only men and women with different levels of ability. With the attending Spirit, we are all that we can be, plus His presence and power, and this is the different dimension that the Christian faith has to offer for our world. The seminaries, then, are concerned with the development of character, the growth of spiritual capacity, and the deepening of the spiritual concern for men in their needs. As Gerald Craig has said in the first paragraph I quoted today, intellectual progress is both more assured and more measurable than spiritual progress. Roman Catholic orders use the term formation for this process of spiritual growth. Across the centuries, they've spent as much time in this discipline as in the academic. We may contend that the spiritual life cannot either be legislated or taught, but surely there are disciplinary exercises in both the academic and the spiritual realm. For one to accept either, he needs both a sense of purpose for his life and a sense of commitment that demands his best. For students to find themselves, it is important that the seminaries and everyone related to them demonstrate a sense of purpose and a priority of values. Are these seminary communities simply activist camps from which men and women move to manipulate pressure groups to improve society, stop conflicts, and lift up the social and economically downtrodden? Or are they educational and spiritual communities in which men and women learn what the gospel is, learn about men and their society, and as well how to relate to all these with a view to bringing God's highest joys and fullest meaning to every life? I propose that the latter purpose, fully realized, is the only way any durable answer can be found to life's conflicts as well as its emptiness. Leaving full latitude for every man to exercise his gifts as God will direct, we would say that adequate theological education is the only worthy goal for us as a denomination. Several things, at least, must characterize such an effort. First of all, it must not be in isolation from society. Yet, it must give priority to the gospel in content and spirit if it is not to be destroyed in the cold winds of secular concern and mechanical procedures. It must take into account truth wherever it may be found, along with the necessary disciplines these truths demand. But biblical truth takes its proper place, and historical setting give appropriate guidelines in avoidance of past errors. It must take into account the professional proficiency of the graduate it produces. But it must be equally concerned with their ability to multiply their ministry through teaching, training, and inspiring a local church membership for effective Christian witness. Such Theological education requires faculty, buildings and equipment, and students. Only the membership of the churches can provide these ingredients. The first two factors call for a dedication of material resources, but as well, an established priority for the distribution that will guarantee, through these institutions, an adequate supply of trained leadership for all the programs of the convention. Inadequate support here provides either an inadequate faculty or a frustrated one, and neither can produce the products you desire. Likewise, the third ingredient, students. These too must be provided by you and the churches. We're not speaking now of parent-called or church-called men and women, but God-called ones. Your church must create a spiritual atmosphere with a proper sense of priorities and values. You must help your fellow church members to determine the lines of separation as to avenues and areas of service, between right conduct and character that produces it, between service to humanity and one profession as over against the call of God for ministers and others who serve in church vocations. Just as a building cannot guarantee a church, neither can an institution guarantee its product without the sense of purpose, material support, and spiritual commitment which a time like ours demands. New churches await dedicated and prepared leadership to make them effective. Mission causes around the world cry out for dedicated and trained manpower. Educational and service institutions call for an ever-increasing supply of well-prepared and committed specialists for scores of new and challenging areas of need. In your seminaries, you have faculties, organizational structures, physical assets, and potential spiritual resources to provide training for all those whom God would call to His service. The extent to which these facilities are used will be determined by your prayerful support of and your dedicated commitment to these seminaries. Such support calls for an offering of your sons and daughters, and for God's kingdom service, and of your wealth to speed them on their way. Yes, there is trouble in the seminaries, but it's the kind of trouble that only we, ordinary Baptists like you and me, can settle. And by His grace, we can settle this and the other challenges that meet us in our day.
Thank you very much, brethren, for the seminary reports. I recognize now Dr. T.T. Crabtree, Chairman of the Committee on Boards, who will bring us nominations for the Boards of Trustees.
Brother President and members of this convention, on yesterday's bulletin, page 3, you will find the suggested nominees of your committee on boards. There are two misspelled names in this list. Under the Southwestern Seminary, it is J-E-R-O-L-D, Gerald McBride. And in the Southeastern Seminary list, Brother Coble only has one B in his name. Brother President, these are our nominees.
You hear the nominations. Are you ready to vote? All favoring the election of these people to serve on the boards of trustees, lift your hand. Down opposition by like sign. And I see no opposition, and these men are elected. We come now to election of officers. Let me recognize first Dr. W. Fred Kendall, who will bring us a report and also who will instruct us on our next election.
The second vice president that was elected was Dr. Lee Porter.
Dr. Lee Porter has been elected second vice president. What's our next election? We do this, don't we? We need now to elect the secretaries of the convention, and heretofore we have done this by methods other than balloting, that is, by standing or lifting the hand. The House is open for nomination for recording secretary. Dr. Willis?
I would like to place in nomination the name of Dr. Clifton J. Allen.
Dr. Clifton J. Allen has been nominated. He is the incumbent secretary. Is there another nomination? If you favor the election of Dr. Allen, lift your hand. If you are opposed, lift your hand. Dr. Allen is elected. Now, registration secretary.
Mr. President, I'd like to present the name of Fred Kendall of Tennessee. I think he comes as near making us understand how to vote as anybody.
Making us understand how to vote without telling us for whom to vote or for what. Dr. Kendall has been nominated. Is there another nomination? Are you ready to vote? All favoring the election of Dr. Kendall as registration secretary, lift your hand. Down, opposition by like sign. Dr. Kendall has been nominated. Elected, I'm sorry. Now we come to the secretary treasurer of our convention.
He's just treasurer.
Just treasurer, I'm sorry. And what is your will at this point? Dr. Allen West? Dr. Porter Ruth, nominated for treasurer of the Executive Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention. Does anyone wish to make a motion that he be elected? I think this has been our custom. Do I hear a second? Motion made and seconded that the rules be suspended and that he be elected by acclamation. Somebody's saying something to me. Treasurer of the Southern Baptist Convention. What is he of the Executive Committee? Executive Secretary Treasurer of the Executive Committee. Are all minds clear except mine? All right, if you favor this motion, would you lift your hand? Now, if you favor the election of Dr. Ruth, will you stand to your feet? I guess that last vote's not necessary, but I want us to express our appreciation to Dr. Root. Thank you. Be seated. Dr. Gaynor Bryan.
Mr. President, my name is Gaynor Bryan, Jr., a messenger from a church in Atlanta, Georgia. And I would like to ask if we might have 2 minutes to make a resolution which we consider to be of a constructive and helpful nature, but of a non-controversial nature, since this is the last opportunity to make a resolution.
Your motion is?
My motion is that 2 minutes be authorized by the messengers for the making of a resolution, the offering of a resolution.
We have no miscellaneous business listed here, and the motion is that 2 minutes be allowed. All right, do I hear a second? Motion made and seconded. Any question? Any discussion? If you favor, lift your hand. Opposition by like sign. And it is ordered. Now, what is the proposition?
My friend from Virginia will offer the resolution.
Dr. Allen.
Thank you, Mr. President and messengers. This is a resolution offered by Robert Alley of Virginia and Gaynor Bryan of Georgia to be referred to the Resolutions Committee. In light of the series of senseless slayings in our land, in view of the easy availability of lethal weapons, and in recognition of Senator Robert Kennedy's strong urging of significant legislation in this area, we, the messengers to the Southern Baptist Convention this 6th day of June, 1968, do urge the Congress of the United States to enact a strong and effective gun control bill which shall cover all types of such weapons. Thank you.
All right, you hear the reading of this resolution, which will be referred automatically to the Resolutions Committee. I recognize Dr. Palmer now for a word on order of business.
The time set by the committee for the consideration of the motion made by Dr. J. Harold Stevens this morning, and also the motion made by Brother Noble Cottrell, the time set for the consideration or voting on these two motions is tomorrow morning at the miscellaneous business period.
You hear these announcements. Dr. Root.
This is just to announce the organization meeting of the Executive Committee immediately after adjournment this morning in the Sky Room. You go up the escalator to the second floor, then up the stairs to the third floor, and the Sky Room up there, purposes of organization, immediately upon adjournment.
All right, brethren, we have come to the close of this session, the Thursday morning session. There will be no meeting this afternoon, except in the small groups, as meetings and conferences have been planned. But tonight we gather again, pre-session music 6:45, formal opening of the session at 7 o'clock. Howard Bramlett will come and lead us in the benediction in the absence of I.B. Hall, Pastor, University Baptist Church, Coral Gables, Florida. It is my understanding that Dr. Hall is not here. Will you stand, please, for the benediction?
Our Father, in this convention, as in our daily walk, we need thy spirit. Help us also to know our great need of the mind of Christ, so that we may increase in wisdom and stature and in favor with thee and our fellow men, for we pray in Jesus' name, amen.